We're talking this hour about the moral and political responsibility of intellectuals. It's a question that has long obsessed the journalist and author Christopher Hitchens. His new memoir, Hitch 22, recounts his own engagement with the great controversies of our time, from the Cuban Revolution and the Vietnam War to the war in Iraq. The book is also a funny and often gossipy account of Hitchens' many feuds and famous friends. Steve Paulson talked with Christopher Hitchens about the role of the intellectual.
I think it's fair to say that there is no one else quite like you with your combined history of being a political activist, a journalist, a cultural critic, your prominence in the media, and your swing in politics from Trotskyite to something more conservative. Do you think the label public intellectual describes what you have done professionally?
I say in the book that I find the term public intellectual a bit iffy. I mean, it's not as if there's much point in being a private intellectual, for example. I mention it in connection with Susan Sontag, actually. I think the definition has to include someone who is in some way self-sustaining, doesn't have a job in the academy or anything of that sort, who, you know, keeps themselves going. It probably ought to include, yes, as you suggest, something to do with engagement with the political sphere, but not in such a way as to be completely politicized.
Now, clearly, taking a stand on the big issues of the day has been central to you throughout your life, whether it was the Vietnam War, the old Soviet Union, or more recently, the war in Iraq. Do you consider this your responsibility?
Yes, I think it's a responsibility for people, even if they are not wholly political or politicized, to try and have educated opinions about major public issues.
Is this a matter of, as you put it at one point in your book, adding up the moral arithmetic when you weigh in on the big and complex issues of the day?
Yes, it is. But I think one has an obligation in the case of a conflict, say, to decide who you think might be in the right or who you think might be the victim. Let me phrase it like this. Very often, the job of the intellectual, so to speak, is to say, well, remember how complex this subject is. Remember how it doesn't yield to simple solutions. But very often also I think it's important for the intellectuals to say, you know what, this is quite simple. I can think of a couple of examples in the fairly recent past. Though Bosnia is a very complicated society, it seems to most of us who'd spent any time there or looked at any of the evidence that actually, in spite of the sort of ethnic mosaic of the place and the layers of complexity involved in religion and culture, that actually fairly obviously an attempt was being made to erase the Muslim culture of Bosnia and as many of its population as could be by a very strong, horrible, irredentist, Serbian-backed militia. And thus that for all the complexity, there was a fairly simple thing to say, which is that oughtn't really to be allowed. That would mean there'd been another genocide in Europe in the 20th century. That would be bad.
So it was incumbent upon intellectuals or people who had some political persuasion, perhaps, to make the case for outside foreign intervention.
I certainly thought so, yes. And several did, and not without effect either. And I think the ultimate result was very heartening. Another case I would make, and I've got a whole chapter about this in my book, is about Salman Rushdie. A lot of people decided that in the case of the fatwa against him, that's to say, on February 14th, 1989, theocratic leader of a foreign state offers money in his own name to have Salman killed for the crime of writing a novel when he's not an Iranian and doesn't live in Iran and lives in London. I thought, well, that's pretty simple. This is a challenge to our simplistic ideas of free speech and the First Amendment.
And what was surprising is a lot of people on both the right and the left essentially blamed Rushdie more than the Ayatollah.
Indeed. They started talking about profanities, various kinds of postmodern nonsense. As you say, a lot of conservatives did this, and a lot of conservative churchmen in the Vatican and the Church of England and among Orthodox Jews said the problem is blasphemy, not the fatwa. Extraordinary. Also, it was an early warning to me, so did quite a lot of rather shady leftists who were beginning this mantra that's now become quite large and quite loud, that, you know, Islam is a religion of the poor and the brown and the downtrodden and the oppressed, and that it's wrong to criticize it because it's a great consolation to these people.
But don't you have to parse this out? I mean, there are moderate reformist Muslims and there are fanatical Muslims. I mean, don't you have to make those distinctions?
Well, I should have said very much you do, yes. But, I mean, you get people saying, but, you know, these Al-Qaeda guys, they wouldn't be around if it wasn't for poverty and unemployment. And I say that's completely the wrong way around. What they do is not protesting against poverty and unemployment. They are the creation of it. They are the ones who want to deprive society of the talents of 50% of its members, the female half. They're the ones who want to blow up anything modern, who want to bring the world back to the 14th century. But you'd be amazed by how often people have a sort of naive view that this must be some kind of third world protest movement.
Now, part of your story is the romance of the left, and perhaps it was never more pronounced in the late 60s when you and other would-be revolutionaries went off to Cuba to see the revolution up close. You came away from that trip fairly disillusioned, didn't you?
Yes. I hadn't gone with any huge illusions, I have to say, because I was a member of a rather anti-communist, anti-Castroite, left opposition group of a sort of Trotskyist character. We had many doubts about Fidel, as people used to call him, but I suppose I wanted to see if it was true that you could have in Cuba a revolution that wasn't one of those drab, uniform, dull, conformist Eastern European satellite-type regimes. That was the claim, that it wasn't going to be like that, but different. A very young country in those days. A very young revolution, only a few years old. Che Guevara, only recently dead. Rather a sexy place, full of young revolutionaries from around the world, some of whom later became terrorists, who I knew, so Red Brigade or Angry Brigade types, and some of whom later took part in the liberation of South Africa as guerrillas. You never knew. Lots to play for. But somehow this atmosphere of control. They took my passport when I arrived at Havana Airport and wouldn't give it back. I said, you'll get it back when you leave. I didn't like that. Just a small thing. I felt immediately not at home. But still, some inspirational stuff, too. So I try and describe it with ambivalence.
One of your icons is clearly George Orwell. And my guess is if you had to pick a model public intellectual, it would be Orwell. Why does he remain the gold standard for you?
Well, I try and describe it in the book when I talk about my early upbringing in the lower middle class in Britain. You know, everyone takes a long time to say which class they think they're in my country. But let's say just escaping from the working class kind of. I was drawn to reading Orwell not by his two classic anti-totalitarian novels, but by the English social novels. They're much less known, but I recommend to any of your listeners, in particular, Coming Up for Air and Keep the Aspidistra Flying and A Clergyman's Daughter, that describe with extreme realism and sympathy the sort of class of person that I came from, these sort of imperial civil service, military, suburban and seaside towns, no money to spare, fear of the labour movement beneath, and slightly cowed and resentful of the upper class above. He caught it so well.
But my sense is more than just you're identifying with his class and how he wrote about it, that you have the sense that he wrestled with the big issues, the big controversies of the day, and for the most part came out on the right side.
Oh, well, yes, but later on, of course, I should have added. I mean, armed only, this is my point, armed only with really one thing, which was a certain literary ability, as he put it, and a power of facing unpleasant facts. In other words, he more or less decided to refuse himself the lie. If I don't think something is true, I'm not going to pretend it is because it might be politically convenient. I'll see what happens if I don't lie to myself or others.
Give me an example of that.
Well, the best example we have is the argument about what actually happened in Barcelona in May 1937 when there was a civil war among the left. These are always, as I keep saying in my book, the most dramatic and painful of all is the revolution within the revolution. And the fratricide within the left. And a lot depends upon whether or not this was triggered by the Spanish Communist Party on the orders of Stalin, essentially trying to bring off a coup, seizing the telephone exchange and various army positions in Barcelona, and using this to put down the left in a kind of pogrom. And Orwell said that it was true. And he said, I can't prove it to you. I can say I saw it. It's a book called Homage to Catalonia that's since become very famous. Was almost unprocurable for many years because people thought he'd just made it up. Now, we now have the archives, long after his death, both from the KGB in Moscow and from the Franco forces in Salamanca in Spain. And, as it happens, he was telling the unvarnished truth. It was at that point that he realized that many people could rewrite history, even while it was going on, so as to make it seem as if certain events had never occurred in the first place, and that was the germ of his great idea for 1984 for Animal Farm. So all of that begins from this one piece of fratricide within the Marxist movement in Catalonia.
Now, your last chapter is titled Decline, Mutation, or Metamorphosis, with a question mark, and it deals with your turn away from the left. And you say this wasn't just a dreary shuffle to the right, and you also suggest that it has something to do with your advancing age and your realization that there are no certainties. How do you explain this shift in your politics?
Well, I've had various commitments and allegiances in my life. I wouldn't say that I wouldn't do them again. I'm not ashamed of them. Some of them I wish I'd done more about. But I've now reached a point where the group I'm most associated with, Richard Dawkins and a group of our friends, is a group that is united really on commitment only to doubt. We're certain only of the uncertainty principle. That may sound like a soft position to end up in, but in fact it's not, because in the present circumstances it commits us very strongly against the modern form of totalitarianism, the theocratic kind in particular.
A lot of people would of course put a different spin on that, not just that you have embraced doubt, but that you've essentially joined the neoconservative camp when it comes to politics in the Middle East, specifically the war in Iraq.
Well, I think whatever word should be used for the regime change faction, of which I certainly was a member, I think neoconservative must be the silliest, because it's a faction that says we're prepared to make war on, to use violence against the status quo. I don't think you can call that conservative. Whatever it is, that's a radical position. And it was the conservatives who opposed it. I mean, the papacy, the Kissinger realists, the Scowcroft, Eagleburger lot.
Well, you were recently interviewed in the New York Times, and you said you still consider yourself a Marxist, though a very conservative Marxist, which I have to say I found very surprising.
Yeah, well, I still think like a Marxist. The materialist conception of history works for me. I don't think it's been superseded or transcended. I think the categories of Marxist analysis are very satisfying. And also, I think much of the best modern history has been written by Marxists and from a Marxist analytical point of view. What it isn't easy for me to say, or actually possible for me to say anymore, is that I'm a socialist. But Marxism doesn't commit you to that. Marxism is a supposedly objective theory, and its prescriptive bits, well, they're optional.
Christopher Hitchens, talking with Steve Paulson. Hitchens is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. His memoir is called Hitch 22.